Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
a sense of absence. Relatives of Israelis held hostage by Hamas skip Passover Seder to protest outside the home of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. One man tells us he can't celebrate any holiday until his brother comes home.
Divide and conquer. After an inflammatory speech by Narendra Modi that's being called anti-Muslim, a political reporter explains the Indian Prime Minister's apparent strategy for securing another term.
Not a criminal, Umar Zamir was charged with first-degree murder after running over a police officer with his car. This weekend, he was acquitted and received an apology from the judge. Zamir's lawyer says he never should have been charged in the first place.
A double-edged sordidness. The former publisher of the National Enquirer and a former friend of Donald Trump takes the stand in New York as the former president's hush money trial begins in earnest.
Casting doubt, Ojibwe playwright Drew Hayden Taylor says he's fine with non-Indigenous students voicing Indigenous roles in readings of his work, but he says professional productions are a whole other story.
And cooler back prevails. Running a marathon is no picnic, but if it were, one British runner could have brought the potato salad because he finished the London Marathon carrying a mini fridge on his back. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that imagines that is a real weight off his shoulders. There are dozens of extra empty chairs around Passover Seder tables in Israel tonight, set aside for those who can't be there. Families whose loved ones were taken hostage by Hamas are heading into the holiday with heavy hearts, waiting for some breakthrough that could bring their relatives home. But others have given up on sitting down to the traditional meal altogether. Hundreds have chosen instead to show up to protests outside the home of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Yotam Cohen is one of them. His brother Nimrod Cohen was taken hostage on October 7th. We reached him in Caesarea, Israel.
Yotam, can you describe what's happening around you right now?
Right now there is a protest just in front of the Prime Minister's house calling for a deal, for an immediate deal and the release of the hostages.
Why did you want to be there, Yotam, instead of marking Passover?
My brother is being held in Gaza for almost 200 days. And we haven't celebrated any holiday since then, since the 7th of October. And we're not going to celebrate any holiday until he returns. And so we thought we'd do something productive and go fight for his return.
If Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came out right now to hear you, instead of sitting down, I assume, with his own family tonight, what would you say to him?
I'd say to him that the time has passed for bad negotiations and for hesitation, and the fact that he hasn't brought a deal to the table yet, and the fact that my brother isn't home yet means he failed. And if he's not able right now to bring a deal, he should resign.
The head of Israeli military intelligence became the first senior figure to step down now since the October 7th attacks, as you well know. What does that signal, if anything, to you? Does that resignation mean anything to you?
Well, I think all the Israeli people saw the resignation of many of the top military personnel, and this is just the beginning of many, I think, future resignation.
Beyond a potential resignation, as you're saying, what would you like the government to do differently to bring your brother home now?
I think the main problem, as we see it, is that the Israeli government tries to prolong a deal or prolong the war for a personal political gain, because as they think, which is probably correct, that when the war ends, there will be re-elections in Israel, and the government and many of the political figures, including the prime minister, would resign. They are afraid. They are afraid of a deal, basically. And we are calling for the government, and specifically the prime minister Netanyahu, to stop the pitiful political game he's playing, and to be a real leader. If he cannot or would not, he shouldn't be the prime minister of Israel anymore.
After all of these months, do you think you and the others who've gathered there will be heard? Do you think there will be a shift in strategy?
I think that as the time passed, you can see the consensus in Israel on the main agenda of the families become more and more, aggressive towards the Israeli government. In the start, the protests were more peaceful and were more sad. Now it's anger. Mm-hmm. We are angry at the government. We think they are failing us. They're doing something wrong, because the fact that the war hasn't ended and the fact that the IDF has came out of Gaza, and the fact that we're releasing some prisoners and without getting a deal means we're not doing something right.
Yeah, in the beginning, there were voices inside Israel, but certainly outside as well, were very much against even talk of a ceasefire. To them, that signaled letting Hamas continue. What specifically would a deal look like to you that would sit well with you?
The end of the war. Because what Hamas is demanding is for release of some prisoners from Israeli prisons, and the withdrawal of the IDF completely from Gaza, and the rehabilitation of the Gaza Strip. And if this is what we have to give Hamas in order to get our loved ones back, this should be it.
What's happening now, Yotam?
The protest has ended, and I'm just making my way home right now.
Yeah. How are you feeling now at the end of this?
I think that the same as at the beginning.
Yeah.
People have been asking us, how do we feel like on this holiday and Leil Seder? But the fact is that today, nothing changes from previous day and the previous week, and every single day feels the same, and we'll feel the same until they return.
I'm so sorry you and your family and so many others are going through this, Yotam. Before we let you go, what do you want our listeners to know about your brother?
I would say that this is my brother being kept hostage. My brother is 19. He's a small boy in the family, and he should be home. And behind the 133 hostages, it's a big number, but behind this number, there are many families and many hostages. Some are alive, some are not. And their families at home waiting to receive their loved ones back and to hug them one more time. And there are other families who just want to bury their loved ones and give them a last sign of honor. And behind this big conflict, the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, are human beings that are being kept under terrible conditions. And it's important for everyone to acknowledge that and to remember this, because maybe the world has moved on from this conflict and from the 7th of October, but they are still there and they're waiting to come home.
Yotam, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
We reached Yotam Cohen in Caesarea, Israel. Omar Zamir's name has been cleared. For nearly 3 years, he's been accused of being a cop killer, of deliberately driving his car over an undercover Toronto police officer. But now a jury has found him not guilty of all the charges against him. Here's what he said outside the Toronto courthouse.
I thought I and Ida made a wrong decision when we thought we should go to Canada. It's a better place for our kids. But I think today I see that Canada didn't let injustice to happen. So I thank Canada.
Omar Zamir speaking after his not guilty verdict on charges related to the death of Toronto police officer Jeffrey Northrop. Nader Hassan is Mr. Zamir's lawyer. We reached him in Toronto.
Nader, such an emotional afternoon, and we can hear it there. as Omar spoke. How is he feeling today?
Well, he's feeling relieved. He's feeling grateful as well. Those words he spoke yesterday, they were straight from the heart. But he is forever sympathetic to the Northrop family. He feels horrible about what had happened. And he always has. He's never wallowed in self-pity for having to deal with this process, this burden. Always, from the very beginning, the first day I met him, the first question he said, do you know how that poor man's family is doing? Are they okay? That's the type of person he is.
And how is Mr. Zamir's family doing today?
Well, they're doing better. They're doing a lot better. They've been living this ordeal for the last 3 years just as much as he has. But he's got a very good support system, a very impressive family. His wife has been a rock. His sister, who was living overseas at the time that this all happened, she moved her kids to Canada to live with them and give him support while this is all going on. Their mother from Pakistan has been here for the last couple of months. They've got some cousins and other extended family who have been giving them great support in their time of need.
Of the many extraordinary elements of this case, particularly yesterday, to hear and see that Ontario Superior Court Justice Anne Molloy said, quote, you have my deepest apologies for what you have been through. That's a rare thing to hear, I think safe to say, in any criminal case. But how did it get to this point? How did a first-degree murder charge come out of this?
He and his wife, who was 8 months pregnant, and their two-year-old were in downtown Toronto celebrating Canada Day. They were just about to leave, and a couple of plainclothes officers rushed up to them in this nearly vacant parking lot. And then they didn't want to talk to the man and the woman, who they had no idea were police officers. So they drove forward to leave, and just as they're trying to get out of there, an unmarked black van cuts them off. So they're essentially boxed in. And so what ensued ended up in a horrific tragedy where Mr. Zamir did drive forward over the officer who had fallen to the ground, and he drove over him, but he had no idea he had fallen to the ground. He had no idea he was there. So this should have never been a first-degree murder charge to begin with. It was an accident all along. If the police had taken a step back and evaluated the evidence rather than rush to judgment and exercise tunnel vision, we would have all known that, and they would have known that from the start, and the public would have known that from the start. Mr. Zamir neither knew that Officer Northrup was a police officer, nor did he intend to hurt anyone. So this never should have been a first-degree murder charge. Now, the fact that it was laid as a first-degree murder charge is concerning enough, but when the police and the Crown got back their own accident reconstruction experts' expert report, which cast further doubt on the testimony of the eyewitness officers who tried to paint a story of murder, then they should have really reevaluated their case, and this case should not have gone to trial.
The judge, it was critical as well of the way the Crown prosecuted this case. But when you talk about rush to judgment, certainly people in Ontario and Toronto saw prominent politicians, Ontario's Premier Doug Ford, Brampton Mayor Patrick Brown, the then Chief of Police James Raymer, speak out quite forcefully when Mr. Zamir was released on bail, angrily about that. Do you think now lessons have been learned?
Yeah, I think important lessons have been learned, should be learned. People in positions of power should never denigrate the bedrock principles that make our society free and democratic, our charter rights, the presumption of innocence, the right to reasonable bail. These were things that the politicians and the chief of police were denigrating. The politicians made their ignorant remarks without knowing anything about the true facts of this case. The chief of police, when he made his remarks, he either knew or ought to have known what the true facts of this case were. So his remarks were troubling for an additional reason.
Did you worry at that moment when you heard such prominent people making those statements that it could end very differently for your client?
I mean, I was worried for his safety because he'd been painted as a terrorist and a cop killer by these prominent folks. So I was definitely worried about that. We were receiving hate mail ourselves as his lawyers for having the audacity to take on this case. But I don't even blame those people who were sending us hate mail because they were fed a narrative that was completely false. But I was heartened to see that once the truth started to emerge, we've been inundated with emails of support for the Zamir family, people saying, how can we contribute to the Legal Defense Fund, which is a total 180-degree turn from where we were 3 years ago.
The officer's widow, Margaret Northrup, says she's, quote, very disappointed in this verdict and has always wanted accountability in this. What would you say to her now?
My deepest, deepest sympathies for what you've been through. She probably doesn't care what I think or what I say, but she's lost her husband, and that is a terrible thing to endure. I hope that she will understand, if not today, but one day, that my client is a good person who never, ever, ever wanted anything like this to happen. And I feel terrible for her. I also feel as if she was misled by those in positions of power who should have had her and her family's best interests at heart, but who instead fed her a false narrative. And so I feel horrible for what that family has gone through.
You mentioned
her family will never be the same again, and the Zamir family will never be the same again. And we hope that they can move on in some way and continue to live fulfilling lives.
Nather, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Nader Hassan is Umar Zamir's lawyer. He's in Toronto. Drew Hayden Taylor is all for representation. The Ojibwe playwright and humorist hails from Curve Lake First Nation, and the way he puts it, his work is all about bridging the gap between cultures by, quote, tickling the funny bone, unquote. His column in today's Globe and Mail definitely contains jokes, but he's also not kidding around. He writes that it's time to change how Indigenous theater and literature are taken up in Canadian classrooms, starting with the notion that only Indigenous students can play Indigenous roles. We reached Drew Hayden Taylor in Toronto.
Drew, I know you get lots of emails all the time, but there was one in particular recently that was sort of the impetus for you to write this particular column. What did that email say?
It was from a teacher, I think, in a grade 11 class somewhere in Ontario, who is teaching one of my plays, Only Drunks and Children Tell the Truth. And he was doing readings in the class with the students. And from what I understand, this school only has two Indigenous students, none of which were in his class. So non-Native students, settler students, were reading some of the roles of some of the Native characters, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And he'd received some concern and some cautions from a part of the school board dealing with Indigenous education development in the school board that might be considered as cultural appropriation, having white students read Native roles. So he was concerned about this, and he decided to ask me my impression of it.
What did you say to that teacher or others having similar discussions?
Well, I thought about it. It wasn't a flippant thing, and I gave him the thumbs up because I thought, you know, school is where you learn things. School is where you learn what you should do, what you shouldn't do. You learn things, that mistakes of history, of the world now, all these different things. And I think in this particular environment, in a school system, I personally, and I repeat this personally, did not have a problem with non-Native students acting out elements of my plays in the classroom. I thought it will, if any place, it will give them an opportunity to walk in as much as possible our moccasins and to sort of know where we're coming from and what's important to us and what we're trying to say. So in that particular situation, I gave him the thumbs up and said, go nuts.
Do you want every teacher who's considering that and has a similar school makeup, should they be reaching out to the authors and playwrights? What should they be doing?
I think it helps to ask each particular I don't know how approachable other playwrights are. I'm sure they are. I think it's a good idea to get their input on this. Some may feel that it's infringing upon their cultural rights. Others may not have a problem with it. I think we are like 5% of the population, indigenous people, and there's several dozen indigenous playwrights out there. And, you know, we're not all alike. We all have different perspectives, mm-hmm. different viewpoints, like mainstream playwrights. So this, as I said, was my view. I think part of schools is to build bridges, to open those windows, all those wonderful cliches about education. And conversation is part of it. You know, when I was younger and we did our Shakespeare study classes in high school, I sort of and had the world of 16th century Shakespeare explained to me. I got a better understanding, and trying to wrap my tongue around those words gave me a better understanding of that universe, of that reality.
Your stance on casting and staging professional productions is different. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I do 180 on that one. And this has been an issue that's been kicking around Canada and to a certain extent the States for several decades now. The fact that it should be Indigenous people that do Indigenous roles on professional stages, in television, in movies, etc. Because here, you're going for that realism, that understanding. I do believe, as well as so many other Indigenous playwrights and non-Indigenous playwrights, that the Indigenous perspective needs to be respected, understood, and that is how you would get a better, more holistic, fuller understanding of that character that you have paid good money to see.
Does that mean sometimes things being put on hold or not even staged at all?
It does raise that issue. Now, as I said, I believe that Native actors should do Native roles. One of the things that's come up is I had a play, I think, in British Columbia that has been postponed because they couldn't find a Native director. And I would like Native directors, but I myself, and this is just me again, don't have a problem with non-Native directors directing my work. I think it's great, and I think it does add something that non-Native directors, that Native directors bring to it, but also I have nothing against non-Native directors. It would be absolutely fabulous someday if I get a call from Spielberg wanting to direct a script or a book mm-hmm. I wrote, and I don't think I would step back and say, no, you can't have it. You're not Native.
No matter who it is, Spielberg or someone else, a non-Native person who might take up one of your works, what questions would you want Mr. Spielberg or another director to consider?
Do the research. I mean, I say this for almost anybody or anything studying Indigenous work. The plays and the novels we do are sort of the next logical extension of oral storytelling. So I would urge people to understand what the story we are telling, why we are telling it, and its sort of growth from the storytelling tradition we had growing up to where it is now.
Those students, Drew, that we spoke about at the top of our conversation, they have your blessing, you said. What do you hope that they will take away from and learn from that reading of your play?
Well, this play is about what's called the scoop up, when Native children mm-hmm. were taken away by the Children's Aid Society and farmed out for adoption. They have to understand what this play is about one of the tendrils of colonization. It's about a 35-year-old woman who was taken away for adoption, finding her way back to the family. We're still dealing with mm-hmm. the repercussions and the remnants of those decisions today. And that's what I would want students to know, that, something happened and it didn't go away. Every decision we make has repercussions for the next seven generations. So what we try and do in a lot of our work as Native writers is basically show that a lot of issues within the Native community, within being in Canada, are generational. It's not just one-offs. They have repercussions just rolling down the generations, and we're still dealing with those today.
Drew, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Drew Hayden Taylor is an Ojibwe playwright and humorist from Curve Lake First Nation. We reached him in Toronto.
How often are you? How is the training going?
I'm very well, thank you, very well. The training is going well, or as well as it can do with a fridge on my back anyway. It's been interesting.
That is Daniel Fairbrother talking to the BBC about how challenging it is to run long distances with a fridge on your back. As someone who once ran several meters while carrying a pizza, I can relate. I was shaking with exhaustion by the time I got back in the car. And one day we'll meet and I can tell him how hard it was to eat that whole pizza in the car while gasping for air. And he can tell me what it was like to kneel after running 25 miles of a marathon with a fridge on his back and then get up and finish the race. Now, I should clarify that Daniel Fairbrother is not a superhero. It was not a full-sized fridge. It was a mini fridge, which still weighs 26 kilograms or 57 pounds. That's about the weight of a pizza, give or take 55 or 56 pounds. You may be wondering why he was carrying that mini fridge. It's because he was trying to raise 10,000 pounds for Diabetes UK. And you may also be wondering why he knelt down just a mile from the finish line. Well, I can answer that by telling you that he knelt in front of his girlfriend, Haley. And then I will play this tape. You will not be able to hear what he's saying, but you'll get the gist.
He supported me all the time. And one thing I've learned about that is actually with people around.
Daniel Fairbrother proposing to his girlfriend Haley with a mini fridge on his back 25 miles into the London Marathon. She said yes, and then he somehow got back to his feet despite his exhaustion and his pizza-like burden and crossed the finish line. Well, congratulations to the happy couple, and you know, it might seem like the fridge convinced her, but it was really Mr. Fairbrother who did the heavy lifting.
I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
The world's largest democratic exercise has begun. Over the weekend, voting kicked off in stage one of India's election, which will span a total of 7 stages over 3 calendar months. When it's over, nearly a billion people are expected to have taken part. But as Indians choose their new government, they're being reminded of some very old tensions, thanks in part to a speech given over the weekend by the incumbent Prime Minister Narendra Modi, leader of the BJP. Saba Naqvi is a veteran Indian political reporter. We reached her in New Delhi.
Saba, Narendra Modi was speaking about Muslims in his speech this weekend. What exactly did he say?
He suggested that if the Congress were to come to power, they would give the first right on resources to Indian Muslims. So it was a very divisive, highly controversial, condemnable speech by many standards. And I think many of the opposition parties have gone to the Election Commission of India and made this point about the speech that this is against the law, against the rules.
Let me just jump in for a second, Saba. As you were listening to that speech, what are the words and lines that Narendra Modi said that worried you and so many others?
He actually named Muslims. Muslims make up about 15% of India's population. And there are areas where they are in very large numbers. So for him to imply that his going out of power means that Muslims are going to get all the resources, it's like Donald Trump saying that if he were to come in, then all the immigrants would come in and take over the US. To explain, that is what he was saying with his suggestiveness. And Narendra Modi has not made such direct statements about Muslims, though he is a Hindu right-wing leader, in the last few years.
The national spokesperson for his party, the BJP, insists the comments are being misinterpreted, saying, quote, "We need to get this in the right context. In the past, a lot of people have come from outside and have now mixed in the society and using resources," end quote. What context is Zafar Islam talking about there?
So the context that the BJP and some of their spokesperson would now need to put it into, they would talk about immigrants from Bangladesh, even from the Myanmar, the Rohingya Muslims. Mm-hmm. They would talk about those who migrated into India and suggest that there is some deep conspiracy by a section of India to bring Muslims in, to make them, so they have higher birth rates. So it's all linked to very old tropes, sort of fault lines about Hindu and Muslim. But the point is, it's usually done through dog whistling by the Prime Minister. This was a direct speech saying that Muslims are going to get everything if you vote me out of power.
How are people other Muslims reacting? You know, what is the impact on the ground when comments like that are made?
Well, you know, there's one analysis of it, because the Indian elections have begun and they take place in seven phases. Mm-hmm. And it's a one analysis that he's doing it because the first phase did not go well. So he's reverted to the Hindu-Muslim rhetoric. But this is also linked to political calculations and trying to push the presentation of Narendra Modi as a Hindu-first leader once again, and to get the opposition to engage on Hindu-Muslim conversation as opposed to conversations about jobs, economy, and price rise.
You've written about Narendra Modi's rise. From where you sit, based on the research you've done and what you've seen, in your mind, what is the key to the success that he has enjoyed and the stronghold he still appears to have?
He is a phenomenal figure. So he has had a lot of success because he also represents that Hindu first constituency in an age of right-wing leaders across the globe. He's also very close to big industry. We've also seen the rise of very big capital through him. It's like an oligarchy of certain industry business houses. He has always known the importance of bringing money into the system to spread the campaign word of his party and himself. Then he's an authoritarian figure. Within his own party, he has transformed the nature of his own party. So the thing is that in a country like India, actually, at times, people like the idea of authority. But he is facing a bigger challenge than was expected in his bid for a third term. And this suddenly crystallized when the first round of voting began on April 19th. Because people were in certain parts of India, communities and caste groups started to assert their demands as opposed to it being just about Modi.
With so many more phases to go, though, as you've said, Saba, what are the chances that kind of challenge will continue, and the chances, for example, for the Indian National Congress Party and Rahul Gandhi?
So we have to see. It's very touch and go, because the BJP is much stronger in terms of numbers. But the question is, if you look at the numbers in Indian Parliament, the BJP right now has 30 seats more than a simple majority. Now, the question is, what are the margins of his victory? Because that will also determine certain crucial policy decisions that India will take in the nature of the state and citizenry. So, we have to, because this first phase has surprised all of us. It has surprised people. All of us had thought it's a one-way election. It's just Modi and the BJP and all the other parties have run out of funds, or their leaders are landing up in jail with corruption inquiries, you know. But the first phase of voting was a surprise for many of us who observed the process closely.
I wanted to ask you, as someone who's observing this process closely, when we talk about the scale, the phases, the significance of this for a journalist covering politics, what is it like to follow an election on this kind of scale?
Well, I've done it before. Mm-hmm. But yes, it is challenging. And, you know, it's a season, the weather, it's becoming hot. It's so blazingly hot right now. But it's interesting because it is a learning curve. It's so diverse. The country is so diverse. democracy is practiced not in one or two linguistic zones, but in multiple languages. So it's complex. It's very complex. So, you know, that is the situation. So it's challenging. It's very polarizing because media narratives here are terribly divided. But it is interesting, and it's what I've been doing. And many of us do go out and villages to villages. We trudge along asking what is going to happen.
Saba, I'm very glad we got to speak. Thank you for your time during a very busy time for you. I appreciate it, Saba. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Saba Naqvi is a veteran Indian political reporter. We reached her in New Delhi. Israel has yet to provide supporting evidence of its claim that, quote, a significant number of UNRWA employees are members of terrorist organizations, unquote. That's according to a report released today by French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna. Over the past 2 months, the minister and a team of investigators traveled to Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Ramallah, and Amman and met with more than 200 people from 47 different countries and organizations. Their job was to review how well the UN's Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA, adheres to the humanitarian principle of neutrality. And on that front, they say it has a more developed approach than many similar entities. What they were not tasked with was determining the veracity of Israel's allegations, which prompted 16 donor countries to suspend or pause funding to UNRWA earlier this year. Those claims are the subject of a separate investigation by the UN's Office of Internal Oversight Services. And speaking with reporters today, Catherine Colonna reminded them of that.
You spoke about the level of cooperation of all stakeholders and all parties concerned with your report. How would you characterize the Israeli cooperation with you, given that, as you may have seen today, the main takeaway from your report is Israel has yet to provide any evidence for its allegations that UNRWA personnel were involved in the October 7th attack. So how would you characterize that cooperation and this main takeaway? Thank you.
Thank you. I covered everybody when I said that we received very good cooperation from everywhere, including Israel. I could go in details who received us and so on and so forth, but I want to repeat that we had an excellent cooperation from all sides. Now, about one of the quotes, I couldn't read everything this morning, but one of the quotes that have been issued does not respect, I think, the text of the report. We've written, and the beauty of writing reports is that you can refer to what's written. We've written that UNRWA has not received evidence by Israel, not that there is no evidence. It's very different. So please, again and again, refer to the content of the report and not to what you hear sometimes about it. I would really appreciate if you could base your comments and base your judgments on the content and not on, you know, preconceived opinions.
You stated that Israel has given no evidence to UNRWA about their claims that any UNRWA employees took part in October 7th. But did you, during your investigation, ask Israel for evidence?
Thank you for this opportunity to have me repeating that there must be no confusion between what we've been tasked for, which is assessing whether UNRWA does everything in its power to ensure neutrality and address challenges, and what the OAS is in charge of. There are two separate missions. So allegations regarding individuals, a difficult case, are in the scope of the OIOS mission. It is not the scope of our mandate.
French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna speaking to reporters at the United Nations in New York City today. This morning in a Manhattan courthouse, the hush money trial of former President Donald Trump finally began. The prosecution and defense made opening arguments, and the first witness testified. The ex-president's old friend and ally, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker, was called to the stand to testify about his organization's so-called catch-and-kill approach to stifling potentially scandalous stories. Devlin Barrett is covering the trial for The Washington Post, where he also co-writes the paper's Trump Trials newsletter. We reached him in New York City.
Devlin, a short first day, but certainly a significant one still. I do have to ask, though, what was the energy from where you sat in the courtroom?
You know, I think the energy was both tense, but also a bit calm. I was struck by the prosecutor in delivering his opening argument. And think about the substance of what he's asking a jury to do. He's asking the jury to find a former and potentially future president to be guilty of crimes. But he spoke the entire opening argument in a very calm and measured tone. He didn't raise his voice like some prosecutors do. He didn't point at him like some prosecutors do. And a lot of the times he spoke with his hands in his pockets, which I thought, you know, was a particularly understated way to approach a case as big as this. So I would say certainly the room was packed. Mm-hmm. Certainly you could feel a bit of tension in the air, but it was also understated, as the way court hearings sometimes are.
Yeah, they're not as sensational as they may appear on drama shows, certainly, but it's still significant.
Correct.
And this one is different than most, as you well know. In terms of those opening arguments, let's start with the prosecution. What, as you watched and listened, did you underline in your notes that really stood out to you about the point the prosecutors were trying to make?
Well, I think there's been a lot of debate publicly about this case. The charges are falsifying business records. The records in question were about paying hush money to an adult film actress. And a lot of people have questioned, like, is this really an important case, a case worthy of all of the things that go with charging a former president with a crime? And what the prosecutors seem to be trying to answer that question by saying, this is really a case about an attempt to keep the truth from voters, an attempt to conduct election fraud in essence. That's not the charge. It's not even close to the charge. But what the prosecutor said was, this is really about election fraud. And I think if they can convince the jury of the seriousness of that, I think Donald Trump's going to have a hard time.
And the defense, what did they clearly want the jurors to have at the top of their minds?
The defense argument was pretty straightforward. One, that the main witness against Donald Trump has been out for revenge for a very long time and is lying and has been an admitted perjurer and an admitted liar. That's Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. You know, the prosecution argument for, you know, Michael Cohen being a bad guy is essentially some version of, well, he was Trump's lawyer, so what does that say? But the other part of the defense argument, which is also, I think, interesting, is they're trying to pick this allegation, this case, into smaller parts and say none of these small parts are crimes. So how is it that the prosecutor looks at the totality of all this and decides, well, now it's a crime? And that, I think, is the core thrust of their argument, and we'll have to see how the witnesses do.
The first witness, to the end of the day, was a little bit of testimony from former National Enquirer publisher and a longtime friend of Donald Trump, David Pecker. What did it signal to you that David Pecker was the first witness from the prosecution?
So I think a lot of times prosecutors want their first witness to be almost a tour guide of the case, someone who explains the world that they're in. And in this case, the world they're explaining is this sort of seamy tabloid world of sex scandals and payoffs to keep some sex scandals from coming to light. And so David Pecker is in some ways the perfect person to be that tour guide. Mm-hmm. He had meetings with Trump about this issue. He allegedly struck an agreement with Trump to make bad stories go away and write good stories about him. And it's interesting to me that the tour guide of this case for the prosecutors is a former tabloid editor.
Yeah, it is interesting to say the least. But in terms of what you were saying about the baggage that Cohen comes with, how does mm-hmm. Pecker potentially counteract that?
You know, I think what Pecker brings for the prosecution, and again, we haven't heard his testimony, so we don't know yet how credible, how damaging it might be to Trump. But based on what prosecutors have said so far, I think what Pecker gives them is Pecker sort of tells the jury what Trump's motive and interest and intent would have been in paying off the adult film actress Stormy Daniels, because Pecker, all through this time period in 2016 that we're talking about, Pecker is involved in discussions with Trump and others about how to kill bad stories about Trump. So I think what Pecker really probably gives the prosecutors is a look inside Donald Trump's mind and an explanation of what he wanted at that time.
It's early yet, obviously, but what's your read so far as you also keep an eye on the jury's reactions?
One sign that is not great for the defense so far is that neither the judge nor the jury seems to really love Todd Blanche, Trump's lawyer, yet. Mm. And that's a hard place to be for any defense lawyer. We'll see how that plays out over time, because, again, it's very early. Yeah. And defense lawyers are known as a group to be pretty charming and work magic over a period of time. But I think it's fair to say that the Trump defense is off to a poor start in terms of the eyes of the judge and maybe sort of the warmth from the jury.
And what was Donald Trump's demeanor through this first day?
You know, there were times where you could see flashes of annoyance from him as the prosecutor talked about his alleged crimes. But overall, he was pretty understated today.
He was awake, though.
He was awake, and he was listening closely to the arguments being made about him. But I would say, you know, having covered him in other court settings, I would say sometimes what has happened in the past is that his frustration level builds and he becomes more demonstrative as a case goes on. So it wouldn't be a shock to me if that's what happens here.
Lots more to watch out for, Devlin. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Devlin Barrett is a reporter with The Washington Post and one of the authors of that paper's Trump Trials newsletter. We reached him in New York. Terry Anderson was more than a survivor. The former Associated Press reporter did survive an unimaginable ordeal. He was held hostage in Lebanon by Hezbollah for almost 7 years. One of his former colleagues, Bob Reed, told The Washington Post, quote, "He was one of the bravest and toughest people that I've ever known," unquote. But he was also an ex-Marine, a father, and a well-respected foreign correspondent who went on to teach journalism and do volunteer work. Terry Anderson died on the weekend following heart surgery. He was 76. In the year 2000, Mr. Anderson went to court in the U.S. to try to get compensation for his time in captivity. That's when he spoke to former As It Happens host Mary Lou Finley.
Mr. Anderson, why are you suing the government of Iran for your imprisonment in Beirut?
Because they sponsored, financed, planned, and helped to execute my kidnapping my imprisonment, my 7 years in prison. I want to see them acknowledge their past. I want to see them admit what they did, and then I might feel that they're not going to do it again. That has nothing to do with anger or revenge or anything. It's just right.
Although you'd have every right to feel angry and vengeful, I know everybody would agree with that. How have you managed putting your life back together after coming out of Beirut?
It took a while. It took a long time to rebuild our family and to get ourselves back on track. My wife and daughter testified yesterday, the day before yesterday, in Washington. It was very, very difficult for them. There were a lot of tears involved, remembering that time and remembering the effects of it, the difficulties we went through after I came home, trying to heal the wounds, trying to get ourselves together and to build a family. It was not easy.
How did you get past all that stuff?
We worked at it. We worked at it very hard. We had psychiatric help. We had counseling.
You still have nightmares?
I have dreams that are not pleasant. I don't know if you call them nightmares. I still dream about being held captive or being taken captive. It's always going to be part of our lives and part of our memories, but you know, we go about our business, we go about our life, we try to enjoy it, and we do. We have a lot of joy and a lot of fun. But It's there. It's always going to be there.
Terry Anderson talking to former As It Happens host Mary Lou Finley in February 2000. Terry Anderson died this weekend after heart surgery. He was 76. After months of delay, finger-pointing, and infighting, the U.S. House of Representatives has approved a huge military aid package for Ukraine. On Saturday, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to approve $61 billion worth of military assistance, overcoming opposition from most Republican members. The package still needs approval from the Senate and President Joe Biden, but both are expected soon. And Ukraine very much hopes the aid can be expected soon, too. The country's armed forces have been losing ground to Russia and have been forced to ration all important artillery shells. Yuri Sak is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Strategic Industries. We reached him in Kyiv.
Yuri Sak, where were you when the news came down that the U.S. House of Representatives approved this package?
Well, I think I was at the same place where half of the population of this planet was. I was glued to the television screen watching live the vote, the counting of the votes. And, of course, this was a historic moment, and it felt like it.
What did you say in that moment?
Well, we were just all, you know, breathless after it happened because, you know, after all the weeks and months of waiting for this moment, when it finally happened, it was almost, you know, in a way, a feeling of disbelief. But we really were jubilant.
It could start moving, as I understand it, after Tuesday. Where will the aid go first?
Well, the package, it's not been entirely confirmed yet, but of course we are hoping to see air defense interceptors in that package. We're hoping to see artillery shells. We're hoping to see some long-range means that will help us deal with the aggressor more efficiently. And of course some of the stuff will be moved to Ukraine quickly because it's in Europe and warehouses. For other items, it may take a bit longer. But of course, everything that will arrive in Ukraine will go immediately to the front lines where it's most needed.
What does it say to Ukrainian soldiers on those front lines that this package is likely going to make its way to them?
It's a huge morale boost. It's a clear signal that Ukraine is not alone in this fight for freedom. It is a clear signal that our partners will not waver, will not be divided, no matter how much Russian propaganda is trying to divide our partners inside their societies and inside their political circles. So indeed, for our troops on the ground, it's a really, really a message of hope and confidence.
But it has taken much longer than Ukrainians and their soldiers might have liked for this package to get approval. What kind of price do you think was paid on the front lines?
Well, for the last couple of months, we have been in what we call active defense. So we were not conducting any offensive operations. But at the same time, as you have seen, of course, we have been successful in targeting Russian oil refineries inside Russian territory. We have been successful in securing Black Sea. We have sunk a number of Russian warships, and we have made it impossible for Russia to control the Black Sea region. So the price, of course, was paid because it is a war and there are losses on both sides. Mm-hmm. But the ratio of losses is considerably in favor of Ukraine. Now, Russians have been, you know, their army has been degraded. We have destroyed so many of their tanks, armored vehicles, artillery pieces. We have destroyed tens of thousands of their troops. And it's of course, incomparable when it comes to our losses.
President Volodymyr Zelensky was asked if this U.S. aid package would help Ukraine win the war or just prolong it. He answered, quote, it depends on when we actually get weapons on the ground, end quote. How would you answer that question?
Well, I would probably say the same thing as our president said, because indeed we hope that, you know, by now, this is the third year of this war, and by now all the logistics and supply lines are all in place, and they're very rigid and solid. So if there are no delays, if there is no procrastination, and the weapons that we are requesting arrives on time, of course this will signify, this will mean a new stage. And again, against the backdrop of the degradation of Russian army, the chances of our victory are considerably increased now.
The majority of Republicans, as you likely know, because as you said, you were glued watching this vote in the U.S. House of Representatives, the majority of Republicans voted against this bill. One in particular, Marjorie Taylor Greene, called it a, quote, betrayal of the American people. How would you respond, or what would you say to Republicans who disagree about whether this money should come to you? They don't think this money should be coming to Ukraine.
I would just tell them that time will show, and they will see that Ukraine's victory is firmly in the national interest of the United States of America and of the people of the United States of America, because the outcome of the situation of the war in Ukraine will have influence on so many other areas in the world, from Taiwan to other places. So even if they are now dissatisfied with the outcome of the vote, they will see with time that this was the only right decision that the House of Representatives could have taken.
If there is a change in the White House come November in the U.S. election, and you have less support than you have now from the highest office there, you know, is that something that you're weighing in your mind or worried about?
Well, whatever change will happen in the White House, or whatever change will not happen in the White House, one thing will remain the same and will not change. It's the national interest of the United States of America. And by now, you know, I will just repeat that it's very obvious that the objectives of the terrorist state Russia, they don't end in Ukraine. You know, the next stage of, if things don't go according to our plan, to the plan of the Coalition of the Free Nations, the Baltic states are next, and this is what our President Zelensky said very clearly, because, and everybody understands this, so there is no other alternative for us jointly but to win, and this is why I'm sure that whatever happens come the elections in the United States of America, the bipartisan support will continue, and, you know, together we will win this aggressive war, and we will bring the perpetrators to justice.
Yuri Sack, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yuri Sack is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Strategic Industries. We reached him in Kyiv. One moment he was searching, and then suddenly, bing, there they were. Or maybe they weren't bing, but I only know the name of one kind of cherry. An archaeologist working on the excavation of George Washington's former estate in Mount Vernon, Vermont, stumbled upon cherries that may have belonged to America's first president. And Nick Beard didn't just get his hands on them. He got his hands in them. He had found the first of two bottles of cherries believed to be 250 years old, which were buried in the basement of the mansion. And there could be more. We reached Nick Beard in Mount Vernon.
Nick, I'm trying to imagine the moment where you get your hands on this bottle and it's intact, which is rare in and of itself. But as you're touching it, what are you feeling for?
Yeah, it was cold. I had gloves on, so it soaked into the finger of my glove, and, you know, pulled my finger back, you know, quickly. It was like, you know, what is going on? Like, why is my finger wet? because the basement as it is right now is very, very dry. The clay is super compact, super dry. So all of a sudden, just finding something that's that wet, it's kind of unusual if it isn't, already, if there's no flooding or anything happening like that.
Yes.
I was like, why would my finger be like that? And then thought about it for just, a little bit longer. It was like, oh, wow. If my finger is wet, this thing has to be completely full of liquid. If it's completely full of liquid, then it's either completely intact or intact enough that it can still hold that much liquid. Because, we know, even though we don't have any intact bottles in our collection, we still know what these bottles look like. So they're pretty large. So it would be, a lot of liquid in there for it to actually be filled all the way to the top. Even before we excavated the entirety of the bottle, just based on the thickness of the glass, right away I can tell that it's going to be a rather large bottle.
And what have you determined is in that bottle?
So as soon as we were able to excavate the bottle and we took it out back to the lab, we removed the contents kind of, as quickly but as gently as we could. Because for an object like this, you want to be able to take the contents out and let it dry out for best preservation. So kind of the first step of that was we were using a siphon to take all the actual liquid out. And then once we got to the bottom of that, the substance turned very gooey, very thick, and we could kind of see little bits of some sort of, harder substance mixed in there.
So what was it?
Well, they were cherries. Little bits of cherry pits. We think the cherries themselves, too, and then we also found a few stems that came out with the substance. And in one of the bottles, we were still able to make out bits of cork that came out.
So maybe a compote or a cherry wine? What's your thinking?
So our best guess right now, it was probably a preservation technique for whole intact cherries. Basically, they would kind of very quickly either boil the cherries or run hot water over them and then place them in a wine bottle with or without liquid, cork it, and then bury it in the ground. Mm. In doing this, it creates a very stable, very germ-free environment for the cherries to kind of preserve themselves on their own. So it probably wouldn't have been for making alcohol. It would rather just been, as kind of a preserve or, eating the cherries intact as is after they had been left in the ground for several months.
Did you taste it?
No, I did not taste it. I was certainly tempted, but smell-wise, it was very mild and kind of fragrant almost. But the thing with cherry pits is if they're left to be in that state for that long, the arsenic inside of them will actually start to leach out. Mm. So as it is right now, that substance is quite toxic.
Maybe it was a poison-making operation. How do you know? Times were rough back then.
Well, probably not. It's even though we don't find many examples of this sort of thing, based on historical accounts, it seems like it was a very common practice.
Understood.
To kind of make these, soft, sweet, preserved cherries.
Given the significance of the discovery, you're saying just to find an intact bottle like that with liquid inside it is so remarkable. Was there a discussion about whether you should leave the contents in it?
Once we actually got the bottles out of the ground, we had to remove the contents immediately for best preservation.
There is, of course, and I'm sure you've heard it, many people have, that story, the lore of George Washington, saying, I cannot tell a lie, telling his dad he took a hatchet to the cherry tree in their yard. It's I believe, been proven to not be a true story at all. But this connection between Washington and cherries runs deep.
Yeah, definitely a myth for, absolutely that. But we do know that he, he had orchards on the property and he was growing cherries. So, even though that story isn't true, they were definitely eating and growing and picking cherries on the property. And Mount Vernon is a plantation, so that work would have been done by the enslaved people working here.
What do you hope is learned ultimately from this discovery? Because you haven't come across something like this as you've been there, right?
Correct. No, this is definitely a first for us. So, I don't think we have something overly specific in mind that we want to find out from these. It's really we want to find out everything we possibly can about these models. So part of that process of what we want to do is we're going to send the contents off to be tested. Now, we're reasonably sure that there's at least cherries inside these bottles, but we don't know what else they could have mixed in. There could have been other fruits. There actually could have been water or some other liquid added right at the start, and it's not entirely groundwater. So those are the kind of things we're hoping to be able to figure out with the testing.
Nick, thank you.
Absolutely.
Nick Beard is an archaeologist. We reached him in Mount Vernon, Vermont. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.